Am I choosing the certainty of silence over the risk of speaking up? When it comes to deciding whether we're going to speak up, we kid ourselves into making the same error over and over. We choose the certainty of what is currently happening to us, no matter how awful it may be, over the uncertainty of what might happen if we said something. This, of course, drives us to silence, quietly embracing the devil we know, when there's a good chance that we really should have spoken up. Here's how this insidious dynamic works. When we're trying to figure out if we should speak up, we often envision a horrific failure and immediately decide to go to silence. Then we look for reasons to justify the choice to say nothing. Our reasoning takes place in the following way. We first ask ourselves, can I succeed in this confrontation? We don't ask, should I try? Instead, we ask, can I succeed? When the answer to the internal query is a resounding no, we decide that we shouldn't try. Effective problem solvers take the opposite approach. Only after they've decided that the conversation should be held do they ask the question, how can I do this? Better still, how can I do this well? If we reverse the order, starting with can and not should, we almost always sell out. We decide to clam up and then justify our inaction. Our two favorite methods for tricking ourselves into remaining silent are 1, downplaying the cost of not speaking, and 2, exaggerating the cost of expressing our views. Downplaying the cost of not speaking. Here's how we minimize in our own minds the cost of continuing to tolerate the status quo. First, we look exclusively at what's happening to us now rather than at the total effect. A professor is boring, unfair, and outdated, but why rock the boat? We'll survive, right? Never mind the fact that thousands of students will be affected over the next 2 decades of that professor's career. Second, we underestimate the severity of the existing circumstances because we become inured to the consequences we're suffering. With time and constant exposure, we come to believe that our wretched conditions are acceptable. We continue to work for authoritarian bosses, stay married to people who physically and mentally abuse us, and work alongside people who ignore and insult us because we tell ourselves that it's not really that bad. It's just how things are. Third, as was suggested earlier, we can't see our own bad behavior when we fail to maintain silence. For example, we think we're silently suffering under the thumb of a micromanager. In actuality, we act offended when the boss asks for details. We say we know how to do the job, cutting her off when she tries to offer a suggestion. We defiantly choose to do something our way. We miss the fact that our own behavior has been degraded. In this case, we don't merely downplay the cost of silence. We miss it entirely. Am I telling myself that I'm helpless? At the heart of most decisions to stay quiet, even though we're currently suffering, lies the fear that we won't be able to make a difference. We believe that either other people or the circumstances themselves make the problem insoluble. That puts the problem out of our control. It's not us, it's them. Have you ever tried to talk to that guy? He's a maniac. Have you ever attempted to tell a senior executive that she doesn't really know how to do her job? Like that's going to work. The truth is that many confrontations fail not because others are bad and wrong, but because we handle them poorly. It's our fault. We decide to step up to a failed promise and subtly attack the other person. He or she then gets hooked, and we're now in a heated battle. Naturally, we see the other person getting hooked, but miss the part we played in escalating the problem by doing such a shoddy job of bringing it up in the first place. We're like the young boy who refused to see his role in an argument by explaining to his mother, "It all started when he hit me back." Even when we do see the role we're playing in a problem by owning up to the fact that our confrontation skills aren't that great, we often act as if we were as talented as we're ever going to be. We've peaked. We'll never get better. We make this assumption because most of us aren't exactly students of social influence. We've spent more time memorizing the capitals of Europe than we have examining the intricacies of human interaction. We rarely think of influence skills as something that a person should and can learn through actual study. But, as this book asserts, these skills can be learned and improved. When you've gone to silence because you're afraid you're not skilled enough to have a crucial confrontation, your assessment may be correct. If this is the case, enhance your skills. There's no use suffering forever. Be careful not to let fear taint your judgment. You may have the skills to deal with a particular issue, but are letting your fear keep you from speaking up. When you're thinking about going to silence, ask yourself if you're copping out rather than making a reasoned choice. Chapter 2. Master My Stories. How to Get Your Head Right Before Opening Your Mouth. Anyone who has ever dealt with crucial confrontations realizes that a person's behavior during the first few seconds of the interaction sets the tone for everything that follows. You have no more than a sentence or two to establish the climate. If you set the wrong tone or mood, it's hard to turn things around. This can be troublesome because when someone lets us down or behaves badly, the last thing we're thinking about is the climate we're about to establish. More often than not, we're completely immersed in the details of what just happened. And if that doesn't consume all of our time and attention, our emotions eat up anything that's left. Consider the following example. Hang the gearheads. Imagine that you're part of an overworked, stressed-out management team that's sitting around a table large enough to double as an airport runway, discussing what it'll take to finish a development project. The phone rings. The quality manager picks it up, carries on a heated discussion, and then slams the phone back onto its cradle. "It's final assembly. The software we just completed is giving them fits," she says with a look typically associated with the act of biting the head off a chicken. "Oh, great. The software is glitchy," shouts the vice president of development. Within seconds, the entire leadership team is complaining about the unorthodox, selfish, weird software testers. Then they arise as one and start marching toward the testing department. Since you've worked with this team for only a month, you aren't sure what's going on. As the team members hustle down the hallway, the operations manager explains that the software is supposed to be tested and retested before it's sent on to final assembly. Otherwise, it often causes problems, and expensive ones at that. "The stupid gearheads only have to run a simple testing package. That way they can catch problems early on, and we never send software on to final assembly, where it can cause costly delays." "Why didn't they run the tests?" you ask.
"That's what we're about to find out," answers the senior VP as the vein on his forehead swells to the size of a mop handle.
He and the other leaders charge down the hall like a band of white-collar vigilantes, and you think to yourself, "This is about to turn ugly." Behold a train wreck. Obviously, this group has a checkered history with the people it's about to accost. The managers are feeling morally superior and are about to create a nasty scene. Of course, in many companies, confrontations may not get that heated. The tone may be softer, the language less brutal, and the threats more veiled. Less punitive folks rely on cold stares, sarcasm, and pointed humor. But the results are probably the same. Employees fail to deliver on a promise, and the bosses jump to a conclusion and jump hard. What makes these crucial confrontations interesting is that the underlying cause doesn't really matter. If leaders start out with strong emotions, believing that they are on the moral high road, the interaction is likely to turn out badly for everyone, regardless of the underlying cause. The scene continues as the managers rush in like so many deputies preparing for a lynching. They catch the programmers checking out a cool new website with a free game download, and then do what one might expect. They snarl at the guilty testers, call them unflattering names, threaten them with discipline, curse them, and pretty much throw a group hissy fit. This ugly battle rages until the information technology manager, who just walked into the building, hears about what's happening to his people and rallies to the testers. A full-fledged shouting match ensues.
It's not long before the IT manager is accusing the rest of the management team of treating the programmers with disrespect, making false accusations, and using offensive language. The managers are now so angry that they could spit. They've caught the weasels red-handed, they really had messed up, and their colleague, the IT manager, has the nerve to be pointing at the management team. Has the world gone completely mad? It takes days for this incident to settle down, and everyone ends up with egg on his or her face. Everyone. The problem, telling ugly stories. Is it possible that everyday people with an IQ higher than that of a houseplant could be so hasty, judgmental, and unfair? Aren't most of us more careful, scientific, and thoughtful? In a word, no. We may not be as blatantly abusive as the managers in the software case, but when we face high-stakes problems, we're just as likely to come up with an unflattering story and act on it as if it were true. Jumping to conclusions and making assumptions. How can this be? During the 1950s and 1960s, scholars conducted a lengthy series of research projects known as attribution studies. Their goal was to learn how normal people determine the cause of a problem. To uncover the thought pattern, they provided subjects with descriptions of people engaging in socially unacceptable behavior. A woman steals cash from a co-worker, a father yells at his children, a neighbor cuts in front of you in the checkout line, and then asked the subjects, "Why did that person do such a thing?" It turns out that people aren't all that good at attributing causality accurately. We quickly jump to unflattering conclusions. The chief error we make is a simple one. We assume that people do what they do because of personality factors, mostly motivational, alone. Why did that woman steal from a co-worker? She's dishonest. Why did that man yell at his children? He's mean. Why did the programmers fail to conduct a test? They're arrogant, lazy, and selfish. How can we be so simplistic and inaccurate? Most of the time, human beings employ what is known as a dispositional rather than a situational view of others. We argue that people act the way they do because of uncontrollable personality factors, their disposition, as opposed to doing what they do because of forces in their environment, the situation. We make this attribution error because when we look at others, we see their actions far more readily than we see the forces behind them. In contrast, when considering our own actions, we're acutely aware of the forces behind our choices. Consequently, we believe that others do bad things because of personality flaws, whereas we do bad things because the devil made us do them. In truth, people often enact behaviors they take no joy in because of social pressure, lack of other options, or any of a variety of forces that have nothing to do with personal pleasure. For example, the woman stole because she needed money to buy medicine for her children. Your neighbor cut in line at the market because he was tending to his two toddlers and didn't notice that he wasn't taking his turn. Your half-cousin was hauled off to jail for holding up a convenience store, partly because of greed. Then again, maybe the slow and painful failure of his business contributed too. Choosing silence or violence. Silence. Not everyone who tells an ugly story angrily leaps into a crucial confrontation ready to exact a pound of flesh, at least not immediately. For many people, it takes a while to become upset, smug, or self-righteous. In fact, when we began studying confrontations 25 years ago, we learned that the vast majority of the subjects we observed were inclined to walk away from broken promises, failed expectations, or bad behavior. When we asked the subjects why they backed off, they explained that it was usually better not to deal with issues the first time they occurred. After all, many of those problems were anomalies. They weren't likely to be repeated, so why make a big deal and come off as a micromanager? Although there may be some truth to this, we also learned that most of the research subjects avoided taking action for fear of getting into a heated argument, which they assumed could lead to even more problems. Who could blame them for going to silence? However, it's not as if choosing silence were a product of scientific inquiry. We back away from people because we conclude that they're selfish or rotten. Then we act on that conclusion as if it were the truth. Who's going to approach these folks? They're selfish and rotten. Therefore, we opt to stay silent. No matter what the reason is, walking away from violated expectations and broken promises can be risky. When you see a violation but move to silence rather than deal with it, three bad things happen. First, you give tacit approval to the action. If you see an infraction and say nothing, the other person can easily conclude that you've given permission. You may feel that you've given permission, and then, realizing that you've given the action the green light, you find that it's harder to say something later. Second, others may think that you're playing favorites. Hey, you never let me get away with that kind of stuff. Third, each time the other person repeats the offense, in part because of your failure to confront it, you see the new offense as evidence that your story about his or her motives was correct. You continue to tell yourself ugly stories, you fester and fuss, and it's only a matter of time until you blow. Violence. Eventually, as problems gnaw at you, there comes a time when you can stand it no longer. You leap from silence to violence. A person interrupts you in mid-sentence for the 100th time, and you finally blow a gasket. Your assistant misses an important deadline for the 100th time, and you come unglued. Of course, you may not become physically violent, but you do employ debating tactics, give people your famous stare, raise your voice, make threats, offer up ultimatums, insult the other person, use ugly labels, and otherwise rain violence on the confrontation. Surprised by your sudden and unexpected eruption, the other person thinks that you've lost all touch with reality. Where did that come from? He or she wonders. But alas, the other person knows the answer. You did it, he or she concludes, because you're stupid and evil. You've now helped the other person commit the fundamental attribution error about you, which feeds that person's silence or violence, and the cycle continues. The solution: tell the rest of the story. Since the problem of coming up with ugly stories and suffering the consequences takes place within the confines of your own mind, that's where the solution lies as well. Effective problem solvers observe an infraction and then tell themselves a more complete and accurate story. Instead of asking, "What's the matter with that person?" they ask, "Why would a reasonable, rational, and decent person do that?" By asking this humanizing question, individuals who routinely master crucial confrontations adopt a situational as well as a dispositional view of people. Instead of arguing that others are misbehaving only because of personal characteristics, influence masters look to the environment and ask, "What other sources of influence are acting on this person? What's causing this person to do that?" Since this person is rational but appears to be acting either irrationally or irresponsibly, what am I missing? You can answer these questions only by developing a more complete view of humans and the circumstances that surround them than the traditional "what's wrong with them." And if you do amplify your situational view, not only will you gain a deeper understanding of why people do what they do, you'll eventually develop a diverse set of tools for orchestrating change. Consider 6 sources of influence. To help expand our view of human behavior, we've organized the potential root causes of all behavior, including failed promises, into a model that contains 6 cells. Cell 1, pleasure or pain. We already know the first cell. It's the one that, considered alone, makes up the fundamental attribution error. People base their actions on their individual motivation or disposition. Does the action motivate? Does the person enjoy the action independent of how others think or feel? Does it bring pleasure or pain? That's the model we already have in our heads, and it's partially true. People do have motives. Human beings do take pleasure in certain activities, and it could even be true that they enjoy making us suffer. However, this model is also the source of influence that gets us in trouble when it's the only factor we consider. Cell 2. Strength or weakness. We can double this simple model by adding individual ability. We now have two diagnostic questions. Are others motivated to do what they promised, and are they enabled? Does the action play to a person's strength or weakness? Does he or she have the skills to do what's required? By expanding the model from one to two cells, we acknowledge the fact that people not only must want to do what's required, they also need the mental and physical capacity to do it. For instance, maybe your company's customer service agents aren't returning calls to hostile clients because they don't know how to diffuse the hostility. Perhaps nurses aren't using protective gloves consistently because they can't put them on quickly enough. With two options to choose from, we also have another story to tell ourselves. Rather than judging others who violate an expectation as unmotivated and therefore selfish and insensitive, we add the possibility that maybe they actually tried to live up to their promises but ran into a barrier. Cell 3. Praise or pressure. From the way adults talk, you'd think peer pressure disappears a few weeks after the senior prom. We constantly warn our children against the insidious forces wielded by their friends, yet rarely do we consider the fact that those forces aren't switched off in some mystical ritual when we finish high school. Adult peer pressure may be less obvious than its teenage counterpart, but it's no less forceful. For instance, what do you think will happen if the supervisor of the software testers walks up to one of them and says, "Hey, Chris, we're running behind schedule. Could you hurry things along?" "What do you mean?" Chris asks. "You know, maybe finesse the final tests. The software seems to be running smoothly." And with that simple request, the tests are dropped. Is the other person being influenced by peers, the boss, customers, family, or for that matter, by any other human being? Should it surprise us that most of the ridiculous things both children and adults do are a result of simply wanting to be accepted? Healthcare professionals violate standards, scientists turn a blind eye to safety, accountants watch their peers break the law, and nobody says anything. Why? Because the presence of others who say nothing causes them to doubt their own beliefs, and their desire to be accepted taints their overall judgment. Peer pressure is the mother of all stupidity. Cell 4. Help or hindrance. In addition to motivating you to do things, other people can enable or disable you. They're either a help or a hindrance. For you to complete your job, your coworkers have to provide you with help, information, tools, materials, and sometimes even permission. Unless you're working in a vacuum, if your coworkers don't do their part, you're dead in the water. For example, what about the software engineers? What if their testing package failed? What if the person responsible for keeping the server online went off to a technical seminar and didn't keep them up and running as long as needed? Who knows? Maybe that's why the software is giving final assembly fits. That is the whole point of this discussion. Who knows? We're going to have to gather data. Cell 5. Carrot or stick. How do things motivate us? That's simple enough. Money motivates people, that we know. Guess what happens when money is aimed at the wrong targets? For instance, managers are rewarded for keeping costs down, and hourly employees are rewarded for working overtime. They're constantly arguing. Quality specialists earn bonuses for checking material, and production employees for shipping it. They too seem to have trouble getting along. Maybe a team-building exercise will reduce the tension. Perhaps conflict resolution training will help. Yeah, right. When they explore underlying causes, experienced leaders quickly turn to their formal reward system and look at the impact money, promotions, job assignments, benefits, bonuses, and all the other organizational rewards are having on behavior. It is sheer folly to reward A while hoping for B.
Savvy leaders and effective parents get this. Here's how this concept applies to a community example. One of the greatest challenges in influencing at-risk youth in inner-city areas is that the models of successful careers that they see often involve the sale of illegal drugs. It isn't just the influence of others that lures them into illicit trade, it's financial. Until they see clear alternative pathways to financial well-being, thousands of young men and women will be lost to this social cancer. Frustrated couples are no less strongly affected by this powerful source of influence. The foundations of thousands of marriages continue to erode as one or both spouses give their hearts to careers that promise increased status or rich rewards to those who pay the price. Cell 6. Bridge or barrier. When it comes to ability, things can often provide either a bridge or a barrier. For example, imagine you're trying to get the people in marketing to meet more regularly with the people in production. They currently avoid each other like the plague because they don't get along. You've aligned their goals and rewards, but marketers still call production folks thugs, and production specialists call marketers slicks. You believe that if you can get them in the same room once in a while, many of their problems will go away. But how? What will it take to get them to meet more often and eventually collaborate? First, you write an inspiring memo. Nothing happens. Then you add interdepartmental collaboration to the company's performance review form. Nada. Next comes a speech, then veiled threats, and finally you create an award program that honors the collaborator of the month. You tell the various division's heads to nominate an employee for the award, and they argue endlessly about who should win. Now you decide to do some out-of-the-box thinking, only this time it's out-of-the-cash-box thinking. The heck with rewards, it's time to turn to other things. Could you do something to the physical aspects of the organization that would allow people to interact more easily and more often? Yes, you could. In fact, if you want to get the two groups to meet more often, think proximity. When it comes to the frequency of human interaction, proximity, the distance between people, is the single best predictor. Individuals who are located close to one another bump into each other and talk. When it comes to work, people who share a break room or resource pool tend to bump into each other as well. Move the marketing offices closer to the work floor, throw in a common area, and the two warring groups may warm to each other. Proximity, or the lack thereof, has an invisible but powerful effect on behavior. Completing the story. When you encounter people who aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, it's easy to wonder, what the heck were they thinking? Left to our natural proclivities, we tell a simple yet ugly story that casts others as selfish or thoughtless. We mature a little bit every time we expand the story to include a person's ability. Maybe others don't know how to do what they've promised to do. We also cut off our anger at its source. Not knowing for certain what's happening, we have to replace anger with curiosity. This puts us in a far better position to discuss an infraction as a scientist, not a vigilante. Throw in the influence of others, and the story starts to reflect the complexity of what's really going on. The fact that social forces are likely to be a huge part of any infraction doesn't escape a savvy problem solver. Only a fool purposely pits people against their desire to belong, feel respected, and be included with their friends and colleagues. Understanding the influence of others is a prerequisite to effective problem-solving. Finally, if we really want to step into the ranks of those who master crucial confrontations, we need to consider the physical factors or things surrounding a failed promise. This isn't intuitive. In fact, rare is the parent or leader who looks at either the reward structure or other environmental factors when trying to bring to the surface the root cause of a behavior. Learn how to do this, and you'll be in a class of your own. Chapter 3. Describe the gap. How to start a crucial confrontation. You've picked out a problem, decided to say something, and considered the possible influences behind it. Now you are about to take action. Before you do that, let's be clear. Almost nobody should be harboring the illusion that he or she has been groomed to solve touchy and complicated interpersonal problems. Almost nobody has. Here's a typical supervisory training regime. A hard-working and competent employee is tapped on the shoulder on Friday afternoon. "Congratulations, you won the supervisory lottery," and promoted to a job that starts Monday morning. Any questions? And it's not as if most employees have actually watched the way a leader deals with touchy issues or failed promises. That kind of thing happens behind closed doors. Of course, business schools, the breeding ground for managers and vice presidents, rarely teach anything about leadership. Most business school courses are about management and entrepreneurship, not leadership. Occasionally, classes cover the way leaders should think, but almost never what they should do. The curriculum certainly doesn't cover crucial confrontations. Professors and students come face to face with crucial confrontations every few minutes, but almost nobody teaches how to handle them. We don't even want to think about the preparation the average parent receives. Heaven forbid that most of us should imitate the social skills of our own adult role models. "Thanks, Mom. I was afraid I was going to miss out on how to paralyze people with guilt, but you've taken time every single day to pass on an important lesson or two." Here's the $64,000 question. How are leaders and parents supposed to have picked up the ability to hold a simple goal-setting session, let alone tap dance through a thorny, crucial confrontation? Through osmosis? If your influence training has been as sketchy as everyone else's, welcome to the club and be sure to pay close attention. We're about to share the best practices of people who know how to walk up to someone and hold a genuine, face-to-face, crucial confrontation. We'll start our exploration of ways to initiate a crucial confrontation by sharing what we've learned from observing people who had the guts to step up to a problem but then quickly failed. After all, knowing what not to do is half the battle. Don't play games. The first technique is the result of good intentions and bad logic. It's called sandwiching. You honestly believe that you have two equally poor options and no other choices. You can stay quiet and keep the peace, or you can be honest and hurt someone's feelings. You use sandwiching in an earnest effort to be both nice and honest. To soften the violent blow, you first say something complimentary, next you bring up the problem, and then you close with something complimentary again. Here is an example. "Hey, Bob, good-looking briefcase. By the way, do you know anything about the $10,000 missing from our retirement fund? Love the haircut." A close cousin to this circuitous technique takes the form of a surprise attack. A leader starts a conversation in a chatty tone, makes pleasant small talk, and then suddenly moves in for the kill. The most unpleasant of these backhanded approaches is unadulterated entrapment, where one person lures the other into denying a problem, only to punish him or her for lying. It sounds something like this. "How were things at school today?" "Fine, same old stuff." "Fine? The principal called and said you started a food fight in the cafeteria. Is that supposed to be fine?" Most people despise these indirect techniques. They're dishonest, manipulative, and insulting. They're also quite common. Don't play charades. Rather than come right out and talk about a problem, many people rely on nonverbal hints and subtle innuendo. They figure that's faster and safer than actually talking about a problem. Some deal almost exclusively in hints. For instance, to make their point, they frown, smirk, or look concerned. When somebody's late, they glance at their watches. This vague approach is fraught with risk. People may get the message, but what if they misinterpret the nonverbal hints? Besides, how are you supposed to document your actions? "February 10th, 2 p.m. Raised my right eyebrow 3 centimeters. Employee nodded knowingly and started back to work."
Don't pass the buck. Some leaders erroneously believe that they can play the role of good cop if only they can find a way to transform their boss into the bad cop. Parents play the same game by bad-mouthing or blaming their mates. By being the pleasant one, they argue, they're more likely to stay on civil terms with their direct reports or children. Here's the kind of stunt they pull. I know you don't want to work late, but the big guy says that if you don't, we'll write you up. If I had my way, we'd all go home early for the holiday weekend. This strategy is disloyal, dishonest, and ineffective. Anyone who wasn't raised by wolves can see through it. Nothing undermines your authority more than blaming someone else for requesting what you would be asking for if you had any guts. If you repeat this mistake, it won't be long before you're seen as irrelevant, merely a messenger, and a cowardly one at that. Don't play Read My Mind. If you scour the bookstores, eventually you may stumble across a few problem-solving texts that make the following suggestion. Since people benefit from learning on their own, don't come right out and tell them about the actual infraction that has you concerned. Instead, allow room for self-discovery. Make the guilty person guess what's on your mind. Here's what this can look like. Well, Carmen, why do you think I called you in so bright and early this morning? I don't know. Is it because I crashed the company car? Nope. Was it because I sabotaged the phone system? Wrong again. Is it because... This tactic is as irritating as it is ineffective. Despite good intentions, asking others to read your mind typically comes off as extremely patronizing or manipulative. Describe the gap. To ensure that you set the right tone during the first few seconds of a crucial confrontation, don't shoot from the hip. Don't charge into a situation, kick rears, take names, and let the chips fall where they may. Instead, carefully describe the gap. Here's how. Start with safety, share your path, end with a question. Start with safety. When another person has let you down, start the confrontation by simply describing the gap between what was expected and what was observed. You said you were going to have your room cleaned before dinner. It's 9 o'clock and it's still not done. Don't play games, merely describe the gap. Describing what was expected versus what was observed is clear and simple, and it helps you get off on the right foot. For the most part, this is how you'll begin a crucial confrontation. However, if you have reason to believe that the other person will feel threatened or intimidated or insulted by the mere mention of the broken promise, you'll need to take steps to ensure that he or she feels safe, no matter the topic. The big surprise. At the foundation of every successful confrontation lies safety. When others feel frightened or nervous or otherwise unsafe, you can't talk about anything. But if you can create safety, you can talk with almost anyone about almost anything, even about failed promises. Of course, the more confrontational and touchy the issue is, the more challenging the confrontation will be. Nevertheless, if you maintain a safe climate, others will hear and consider what you're saying. They may not like it, but they'll be able to absorb it. Make it safe for people, and they won't need to go to silence or violence. Mutual respect. As you first describe the gap, if your tone of voice, facial expression, or words show disrespect, bad things are currently happening to the other person. You're not respecting that person, you're speaking in an uncivil tone, your manner is discourteous, your delivery is contemptuous. In short, you've held court that we do not respect him or her. Problems are bad things, the other person is connected to the problem, and therefore we must think he or she is bad. Despite our best efforts, others feel unsafe and go to silence or violence, and we haven't even made it all the way through our first sentence. Let's add a skill to help us with our very first sentence.
We'll use it as a preemptive tool for stopping disrespect in its tracks. It's called contrasting. It's the killer of the fundamental attribution error. Here's how it works. Before you start the confrontation, anticipate how others might assume the worst. How might they feel disrespected? For instance, if you bring up a quality problem, the other person may believe that you think he or she is unskilled in general. If you address poor effort on a specific project, the other person may conclude that you believe he or she isn't motivated or can't be trusted, or perhaps you don't like him or her or are about to take disciplinary action, and so on. You've noticed a problem, and the other person prepares for the worst before you can finish your thought. To deal with these predictable misinterpretations, use contrasting. First, imagine what others might erroneously conclude. Second, immediately explain that this is what you don't mean. Third, as a contrasting point, explain what you do mean. The important part is the don't portion. It addresses misunderstandings that could put safety at risk. Once safety is protected or reestablished, the do part of the statement clarifies your real meaning or intent. Establish mutual purpose. When a conversation turns ugly with greater intensity and speed than you ever imagined it could, it's usually because others misunderstand not your content, but your intent. You are speaking respectfully. That part you got right. You merely want to solve a problem in a way that keeps the relationship on solid footing, but the people you're talking to think differently. They believe that the only reason you're bringing up the infraction is that you're out to humiliate them, make them do something they don't want to do, overthrow their authority, or otherwise cause them pain and sorrow. They believe that bad things are about to happen to them. You can't let this happen. If you think others are likely to harbor bad thoughts about your intentions before you've even said a word, take another kind of preventive measure. Establish mutual purpose. Build common ground before you even mention a problem. Let others know that your intentions are pure, that your goal is to solve problems and make things better for both of you. Start with what's important to you and them, not just you. Establish mutual purpose. Here's an example. If it's okay with you, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking about how we made that last decision. My goal is to come up with a method we're both comfortable with. I'd like to give you some feedback that I think would help you be more productive with your meetings. Add contrasting. I don't think this is a huge problem, but I do think that if you were to make a couple of small changes, things would run a lot more smoothly. Ask for permission. If the topic you're about to address is traditionally off-limits, particularly sensitive, or something a person in your position doesn't normally discuss, ask for permission to discuss it. Be gracious. Don't plunge into a delicate topic without first seeking permission. Asking permission is a powerful sign of respect. It also helps allay people's suspicion that your intentions toward them are malicious. Speak in private. This safety tip is both obvious and easy. Always discuss problems in private. No matter where you may encounter a problem, retire to your office or another secluded setting where you can talk one-on-one. Never conduct public performance reviews. Never discipline your children in front of their friends. Never confront your spouse in the middle of a dinner party. Never talk about friends, loved ones, direct reports, or bosses at the water cooler behind their backs. Speak in private, one-to-one, and face-to-face. Avoid the following common violations of this principle. Inappropriate humor. Don't violate privacy by masking a public performance review with thoughtless humor, as in this example. Well, look who just arrived. Forget how to find the meeting room, did you? For many people, this is a hard habit to break. It takes years to learn how to craft the perfect public punitive remark, veiled enough to deny, clever enough to get a laugh, and pointed enough to be nasty. Nevertheless, drop the cutting sarcasm. A group attack. Don't deal with individual problems in meetings or public gatherings by chastising the entire group. This cowardly tactic fails doubly. First, the guilty parties may miss the fact that they're the target of your snide comments. Second, the innocent people resent the fact that they're being thrown in with the guilty. Once again, problem-solving should be done in private, one-on-one. If you can create enough safety, you can talk about just about anything with just about anyone, even a defensive boss. You note a problem, step out of the content of the conversation, and restore mutual respect and mutual purpose. Combining safety skills. Let's see how these safety skills can be combined to help form the first few phrases in a crucial confrontation, particularly if the topic is touchy or the person you're dealing with is in a position of power. How, for example, could you start with safety when challenging a very defensive boss? Share your path. Let's look at the second step in describing the gap. We started with safety and will be doing our best to watch for fear throughout the discussion. When called for, we may start with a preemptive contrasting statement or describe our common ground. Once the other person feels safe, it's time to describe the gap. Start with facts. As a general rule, when you are sharing your path, it's best to start with the facts, what you saw and heard. Don't start your stories. If you do, people are likely to become defensive. Instead, describe what the person did along with the result. By talking about the result, you let the person know why you've brought up the issue. You've framed the problem. Stay external. Describe what's happening outside your head. You cut the person off in mid-sentence, as opposed to what's happening inside your head. You're rude. Explain what, not why. Facts tell us what's going on. You spoke so quietly it was hard to hear. Conclusions tell us why we think it's going on. You're afraid. Gather facts. If others complain to you about their friends and co-workers, they're likely to tell stories and leave out the facts. He's arrogant. She's unreliable. Their team is selfish. When this happens, probe for details. Ask them to share what they actually heard and saw. Even when it comes to our own thinking, it's often difficult to remember the original facts. Most of us have an experience. You spoke nonstop about yourself and didn't ask me a single question. Tell a story. You're egotistical. Generate a feeling. I don't like being around you. And then forget the original experience. In some cases, we may not even be aware of the other person's subtle action that led to the feeling. Thus, we end up walking around with feelings and stories, but are incapable of holding crucial confrontations successfully, because we lack the facts required to help others understand what we're thinking. Gathering the facts is the homework required for holding a crucial confrontation. Here's the bottom line. Every time you share a vague and possibly inflammatory story instead of a fact, you're betting that the other person won't become defensive and can translate what you're thinking into what he or she did. That's a bad bet. Share the facts, describe the observable details of what's happening, cut out the guesswork. Tentatively share your story. As we suggested earlier, sometimes a person's behavior can be moderately annoying, and maybe that individual has even broken a promise, but what really has you distressed is the fact that you believe that his or her intent is less than noble. You're trying not to make the fundamental attribution error, but facts are starting to pile up, and it's hard to keep assuming the best. Keeping an open mind is one thing, being naive is another. Continually watch for safety problems. Warning. Once you start to tell your story, no matter how tentative you are, there's a chance the other person will become defensive. If, for example, you believe your teenage son has stolen money from you, regardless of how tentative you are, you're likely to experience something like this. You. Given that you're the only one who's been in the house in the last 4 hours and $200 is missing out of my wallet,
it's hard for me not to wonder if you took it. Son, I can't believe you're calling me a thief! Stomps out of room and slams door. How do you handle this kind of defensiveness? First, recognize it for what it is, a threat to safety. The problem is not that the other person can't handle the content you're offering. It's that he or she doesn't feel safe with you discussing it. When you realize that the problem is one of safety, you'll do the right thing. Step out of the content and rebuild safety. Decide whether the problem is that the other person feels disrespected, or believes your intentions are bad, or both. Then use the contrasting skill we described earlier to relieve that person's mind. You. I'm not calling you a thief. I am trying to come up with explanations for what just happened. Can you see how I would wonder, given the facts I just described? My intention here is not to accuse you, but to find out what is really going on so I can solve this problem. Can we talk about it? If you start to share your story and the other person becomes defensive, take away his or her fear. Step out of the content and restore safety. End with a question. You started the crucial confrontation by doing your best to make it safe. You shared your path in a way that continued to make it safe. Now it's time to bring your opening paragraph to a close, still maintaining safety. End with a simple diagnostic question. What happened? Make this an honest inquiry, not a veiled threat or an accusation such as, "What's wrong with you?" As you finish off your description of the failed expectation, your goal should be to hear the other person's point of view. If you started with safety and presented detailed facts, the person responsible for the infraction should understand what the problem is and feel comfortable talking about the underlying cause and the eventual solution. Don't underestimate the importance of this sincere question. This is a pivotal moment in the crucial confrontation, one that will sustain the safety you've created. If you sincerely want to hear the other person's point of view, you let him or her know that this is dialogue, not a monologue. You help the other person understand that your goal is not to be right or to punish, but to solve a problem, and that all the information must be out in the open for that to occur. So end your opening statement with a sincere invitation for the other person to share even completely contrary opinions with you. Finally, as the other person answers the question, "What happened?" listen carefully. Diagnose the root of the problem. Which of the six sources of influence are at play? Are they unmotivated? Are they unable? The solution to each alternative is quite different. You don't want to try to motivate people who can't do what you've asked, or enable people who don't care. We'll look at ways to deal with each of these problems in the next two chapters. For now, remember to listen for the underlying cause. Chapter 4. Make it motivating. How to help others want to take action. Let's look at where we are in the problem-solving process. Myra, an employee who works for you, failed to complete an important quality check. You observed the gap, decided to deal with it, and tried to determine the right problem to discuss. Since this was the first infraction, you've decided to talk about the content. She didn't complete the quality check. You admire Myra, and so it is easy to impute good motive. Now you describe the gap. After your brief and effective problem description, Myra responds. Remember to diagnose. The way Myra responds to your description of the gap will determine what you do next. She determines your path, not you. You'll learn where you're going by diagnosing the underlying cause of the problem. Is it a matter of motivation, ability, or both? If Myra says, "I couldn't do the procedure you asked for," you'll need to figure out why. Which of the three ability forces is coming into play? If Myra replies, "Come on, what's the big deal? It's a stupid little quality check. I don't really have to do it, do I?" you're staring at a motivation problem. Which of the motivational forces is at work here? Knowing how to bring to the surface and resolve all the underlying causes requires a great deal of skill. If you miss a single ability barrier, the other person won't be able to cooperate. If you misinterpret the underlying motivational block, you'll be pushing the wrong buttons. You'll also have to choke back the desire to pull out the big guns to motivate. It's so fast and easy. Or pull out your big ideas to enable.
It's so fast and easy.
Both methods are tempting, and both will be wrong.
It's about to get complicated. We begin our journey into the land of multiple causes with a warning. It's about to get complicated. We also offer a promise. If you follow the best practices of those who routinely step up to crucial confrontations and handle them well, you too will succeed. After hemming and hawing for a few seconds, Myra explains that she really didn't want to do the job and asks, "What's the big deal? Is it really worth the effort?" From this particular response, we'll conclude that she's not motivated. Other signs that a person isn't motivated include the following. "I had more important things to do. It wasn't my idea to switch jobs. If you think I'm going to work on something that isn't on my performance review, you're wrong." All point to underlying motive. All imply, "I chose not to do it." How do we make it motivating for Myra? What do we do to get Myra to march to the beat of our drummer, not her own? How do you reach into other people's psyches, regardless of their power or position, or better still, regardless of your power or position, and motivate them to do what they promised to do? Hint: your power doesn't matter all that much. In fact, in many cases, the more you think you need power to influence others' motivation, the less likely you are to do it well. Stick with us and you'll see why. Motivation with a capital M. When others willfully break a promise, particularly when they cause us loads of grief, we want so desperately to motivate the guilty parties that the whole concept of motivation takes on mythical proportions. We think of motivation with a capital M, arm-flailing speeches echoing through a coliseum with the crowd cheering. Or perhaps we envision motivation as the raw use of power delivered in a satisfying and vengeful strike to the ego. Or maybe we think of it as a tool bag chock full of clever techniques, just underhanded enough to trick people into compliance, but sincere-looking enough to maintain a patina of professionalism. And on a good day, maybe our best day, we think of motivation as the ever-popular art of getting people to do what you want them to do because they want to do it. Of course, none of these views is particularly helpful. All lead to behaviors that eventually get us into trouble. Even the last cloyingly patronizing statement, "We think it's our job to get people to want what we want," is fraught with problems. It works only if we're omniscient. What we want is always right. Getting to the root of motivation. Contrary to popular myth, you don't have to wield power or provoke fear to be an effective motivator. In fact, it's better if we don't think of ourselves as larger-than-life figures, burdened with the challenge of bringing the nearly dead back to life through various methods of motivation. That kind of flawed thinking is exactly what gets us into trouble. Let's not forget Melissa from the introduction, the best of the best in the land of flailing fists. She was far too small to intimidate anyone, and rarely, if ever, did she use her formal authority or position power. In fact, the amount of power you have has little to do with how well you motivate others. Remember, we have watched people with almost no authority motivate their bosses' bosses. Motivation, it turns out, is actually rather boring. It has little to do with clout, chutzpah, or even charisma. In fact, motivation is about expectations, information, and communication. Three approaches to avoid. One thing is for certain, three of the more popular methods, charisma, power, and perks, don't work very well. They all have the potential to change people's view, and so they all have the potential to change people's behavior. Unfortunately, relying on these heavy-handed methods can be dangerous, and rarely sustains behavior over the long run. Yet these methods remain enormously popular. In fact, they hold a nearly sacred place in the current literature. Let's consider each method in turn. Don't rely on charisma. It's time to kill a myth. To be an effective motivator, you don't have to be awe-inspiring. Everyday acts of motivation are almost always subtle, rarely elicit awe, and never make the papers. Nevertheless, the myth of charisma continues to thrive. Books, television programs, and movies positively ooze with scenes that are designed to make audiences gasp with admiration. Charisma makes for good drama, however, it has precious little to do with leadership. Rest assured that you don't have to be charismatic to be influential. Don't use power. Let's move on to the next big mistake. Raw power, painfully applied, may move bodies, may even get people to act in new ways, but it rarely moves hearts and minds. Hearts and minds are changed through expanded understanding and new realizations. The flagrant and abusive use of authority, in contrast, guarantees little more than short-term, bitter compliance. Every time we decide to use our power to influence others, particularly if we are gleeful and hasty, we damage the relationship. We move from enjoying a healthy partnership based on trust and mutual respect to establishing a police state that requires constant monitoring. Every time we compel people to bend to our will, it creates a desolate and lonely work environment. Gone is mutual respect and the camaraderie it engenders. Gone are the simple pleasantries associated with rubbing shoulders with colleagues who admire and pull for each other. Gone is the sense that we're laboring together to overcome common barriers. It's a horrible thing we do when we decide to routinely unleash our power as a way of motivating. When we do, our relationship with others is forever changed. We move from respected partner to feared enforcer, and then we pay. Be careful with perks. Now for the last of the common motivational errors, the hasty use of extrinsic rewards to motivate what should already be intrinsically motivating. Parents long ago learned not to make this mistake through their failed attempts to reward actions that should be rewarding in and of themselves. For example, if you want your children to read, or better still, love to read, what's the best way to lure them away from TV programs and video games? More than a few parents have chosen to pay their kids to read. The theory is that if you pay them, they'll read, and if they read, they'll learn to love reading. Unfortunately, extrinsic rewards often kill intrinsic satisfaction. These children learn to read for money, not for reading's sake. Then, the minute you remove the cash, they're back at the TV or the video game. Similarly, if you continually use special perks to encourage people to do what should be a routine part of their jobs, in effect perfuming the consequence bundle, you could be undermining or even destroying the satisfaction that comes from doing the job. It also takes attention away from the legitimate reasons for the work. When they are applied to routine behavior, extrinsic rewards confuse purpose. Special rewards should be reserved for special performance.